Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Publishing, pints, and political history. That's what's up this morning. We'll start by meeting the new executive editor of the Burlington Free Press. Then we'll head to Middlebury for an IPA or two at Drop-In Brewing. At 10, we'll hear the stories of Tom Salmon and Patrick Leahy, and that's followed by a half hour of open phones. But let's begin at the Free Press. And when I say the new executive editor of the paper, I should also mention that readers of the Free Press will know him quite well. Aki Soga has been at the Burlington Free Press since 1991 and just recently was hired to replace Emily Stiliani as the newspaper's executive editor. What a perfect opportunity to chat with Aki about his many years at the paper and the new task he has before him. Aki Soga, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Aki a question or to share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Aki, what was the job that first brought you to the Free Press over 30 years ago?
It was as a features reporter, kind of a general assignment features desk job.
And what did that entail?
Lots of things. You know, I did a little bit about lifestyle, health coverage. That's the thing that sticks in my mind, that the one story that really stands out to me from my short stint on the features desk is about hangover cures.
Oh,
I started in December, so you know one of the stories I got was writing about hangover cures. Bottom line, that there is no such thing. But
well, if you're in the UK, you have one of those big Irish or English or Scottish or Welsh breakfasts in the morning. That's the closest I've ever come to a hangover cure. But you're probably right. Do you remember the very first assignment that you had when you got to the Free Press?
Boy, trying to think. It might have been, and this was early December.
Yeah.
So it might not be right, but it was a really, really cold day. And myself and then photographer Karen Pike, we went out looking for people working outside.
Oh, man.
and we drove, I think, down to Virgin's before we found someone working outside.
Right now, Aki, you're probably thinking, man, it's 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, and he's got me stretching my mind to 31 years ago. What other positions have you held at the Free Press through these years?
All right, so after a short stint on the features desk, I moved on to become a business reporter, and that really was my background at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And did that for a few years. Then I became business editor, did that for about a decade. And then I became the opinion page editor or the editorial page editor under various titles, and I did that for about a dozen years.
Yep.
And then after that, I did, kind of a general news editing job until, end of June when I did this job.
Yeah. And what was it? You said you had a business background, business reporting background. What was it you had been doing before you came to Vermont to the Free Press?
So I was a correspondent with an organization called Knight Ridder Financial News in Tokyo. And, you know, Knight Ridder doesn't exist anymore, but they were a fairly major, no, they were not fairly, a major newspaper chain back then. Some really great newspapers, including the San Jose Mercury News, did great work. You know, the guy working out of our office, Lou Simons, had won a Pulitzer for his coverage of the Marcos overthrow. So, you know, and that, I think that year, that was like one of several Pulitzer they won that year. Yeah. Anyway, Knight Ridder Financial News is for people who are familiar with Bloomberg terminals. That's what we were before Bloomberg existed. We were a news organization's main client was financial traders, and they had proprietary, very expensive terminals on their desk that fed them real-time news and market data. This was before the internet was really a thing.
Yeah.
So this was something that people would pay a lot of money for, and I did that for a few years in Tokyo. And before that, I was a reporter and editor of an English language paper in Tokyo as well. So anyway, I had a financial news background. I also have a degree in economics, which is, coming from a liberal arts college, doesn't mean a whole lot. But
Well, Aki, what's interesting is I've learned that at one point, probably for a brief moment, we were Knight Ridder brethren. I, in grad school, worked in the sports department of the Miami Herald. Starting out setting the agate page and then becoming a copy editor in the sports department. So, there we go.
It was a good company.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it really was. Now, what have been some of the most important stories that you have covered at the Free Press?
Big stories. When I was on the business desk, we wrote about all the turbulence at IBM. Mm. When I started covering business, they were ramping up. I think they were up to like 8,000 employees locally.
Right.
And then the slow shedding of jobs and scaling back of their mission here. And that was a big story for us on the business desk for years.
Right.
On the opinion side, we covered the marriage equality debate.
Right.
And for me, I think that our endorsement of marriage equality was one of the most important editorials we wrote because we reversed course. Earlier we had, previous editorial boards had come out against marriage equality, the concept of it. And I don't think we weighed in on the civil unions, I think because they couldn't come to a consensus on the board.
Oh, wow.
And then, when the final marriage equality bill was before the legislature, we came out in favor of it. And the way we did that is we kind of did a point repudiation of our previous position against. So we were very transparent that we were changing our position on this debate. And,
right.
I like that transparency. Also, Bernie Sanders' first run for the presidency.
Sure.
I'm not sure if in the scale of things, how important that's going to turn out to be, but it certainly was fun.
Yeah, it was quite a seminal moment. I remember being down there at the lakefront, and there was so much energy. 5,000 people showed up. It was, pretty special to have been there at that really phenomenal moment. Are there certain people you've interviewed that have stood out for you because of either their personalities or their accomplishments?
Boy, again, you're hitting me in the morning with details.
Yeah. You're very kind to do Monday morning at 9 o'clock. And I appreciate that, Aki.
The ongoing dialogue I've had with Bernie Sanders has been interesting. I met him very early after coming here.
Yep.
I remember vividly the first time I covered him, he was giving a speech in Essex Junction about something to do with veterans. And a group, and there was a small group of people sitting on chairs. And when he got up to speak, a group of them, and I assume they were veterans, stood up and turned their backs on him. Hmm. And then shortly thereafter, he became one of the most vocal advocates for compensation for people who had been exposed to Agent Orange. And,
right.
Completely turned that support around. Veterans became one of his most ardent supporters. it's savvy politics. I was impressed with that. And I remember he used to call me into his office once in a while and kind of lecture me on economics.
Imagine that. Boy, he turned it around literally and figuratively with the veterans. And Aki, I promise we'll move on to the present day soon and the new position. But tell us about being a finalist in 2012 for the Pulitzer Prize for your editorials.
So that was a joint effort by myself and then executive editor Mike Townsend, and we had decided we had, as we used to do, to go to court to, you know, get government to release information.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that triggered this was that I think it was that we had sued the city of Burlington over some emails having to do with, one of the scandals related to the Burlington Telecom thing. I think anyway, we had won, and it was a fairly expensive, drawn out suit. We had won, but the judge ruled that, yes, these are public records, but we're going to allow the city to, you know, withhold majority of them because it would prove an embarrassment to the people involved.
Wow.
And you know, at that point, Townsend gave up and says, the courts are never going to let us have, you know, information we want. We need to change the laws. So we started this at least 2-year campaign of going after the legislature to make public records more accessible to the public. And, you know, it was really an honor to be recognized for that effort.
Yeah. Aki, a lot of people believe, I think, when you get to the point in your career when you write editorials, that it's your chance to just rant. But how do you construct an editorial that gets a point of view across while still being fair and measured?
So editorials are held to the same standards of accuracy and fact-based reporting that the rest of the our newsroom is. So, you know, I can't make stuff up when you're writing this stuff. And you know, if you want to have an impact, if you want to change people's minds, you really need to reach the people who disagree with you. So rants are definitely not the way to do that.
Right.
So, and what we've also found is that, you know, you can't write about something once and let it go. If you really want to affect something, you need to come back to it time and again. So those are three factors. And mm-hmm. you know, you want to make a measured argument. I think you don't flip somebody's mind completely 180 degrees, rarely. So you need to make inroads, find areas of, you know, common ground, and then start from there. Says, okay, you know, you want people to agree on what the issues are, and then you want to present your side in a way that's going to at least engage people who may disagree with you. And the other thing I found is that, you know, when I first started writing editorials, I read a lot of editorials from other news organizations, including the big ones like New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal. And I found the ones that really engaged me, and I counted words, were all about 400 words long.
Huh.
If you went on longer than that,
yeah.
Unless you really were interested in the issue, you weren't going to read the rest of it. So I set that as a goal for myself to keep editorials to about 400 words. And in general, I think it served me well. Sometimes really difficult to write that short, but
it is. I'm not sure people understand how short 400 words is, but it you've really got to edit yourself to keep it that tight. Now, when Emily Stigliani announced that she was leaving for the position with the Sacramento Bee, did you immediately decide that you would apply for the position of executive editor?
Yes, I did. You know, I've been with the Free Press a long time. I've held a lot of jobs, and it just felt like the logical next step.
And Aki, for those outside the newspaper business, what exactly are the responsibilities of a newspaper's executive editor?
So I am the final authority on, you know, everything that gets published. That's not to say I touch every piece that gets published.
But, right.
You know, it's ultimately my responsibility. I'm, you know, also have a bunch of administrative duties, you know, like I got to pay rent and stuff like the cable bills and stuff like that, but the less glamorous side of the job. But, yeah, you know, it's ultimately, it's I'm the one that's responsible. Like I said, I may not touch everything, but, you know, I work with a very talented editor, April McCollum.
Yeah.
And, you know, she has my complete trust, so I don't need to look at every single piece that gets published every day.
I just hope they don't come to you for your signature on checks on deadline. And Aki, how much direction, interaction is there between you and Gannett, the paper's owners?
They don't determine our content. Local content, you know, there's a lot of shared stuff with the we're part of the New England group we do. There are some national initiatives. I know that we're about to set up a voting rights guide that we took part in. There's things like that that we do. They rarely tell us what to write. They might say, hey, we're doing this national package. I think, you know, Burlington has interesting angle on this, so we'd like you to contribute a story, so we'll do that sort of thing. But in general, it's locally directed. So, you know, the feedback we do get is we have a lot of back office support that readers never see, and one of them is tells us, you know, what stories are doing well, what's not doing well. And that helps us either, you know, shift the focus of coverage or tell us that we need to change how we're writing about a subject if we think it's really important and it's not doing well. Sometimes it's just our approach to that story that's not doing well. And that kind of like this huge operation behind us that helps us along in that.
Yeah. Big picture, are there ideas that you'd like to institute at the Free Press?
Yeah, there's some things that I like to bring back. I think we, you know, shifted our focus as we moved. You know, number one, our main focus is our online news site. You know, print is still very important to us. We try to serve those readers, but in the way that news is consumed today, you know, the newspaper that gets published 24 hours after news happened is less of that kind of medium.
Right.
So we tried to, you know, it's we take a more maybe a approach to stories to offer insight and things like that. But as far as our overall coverage, I'd like to see us get back into the State House, which we haven't done in a few years. And that's, you know, partly we want to see how else we could cover Vermont politics and I guess a little more swing the pendulum back towards traditional news coverage in terms of what we cover. We're still not going to be obsessed with, you know, covering meetings and how a bill is doing and things like that. We're definitely going to remain focused on the impact and accountability of government. But, yeah, those are two areas that I think we like to do.
Well, I'm watching vinyl come back, so I'm hoping print comes back. But it's no secret
that I'm a huge film documentary
fan.
So.
There you go. but are there signs that you're seeing that might show that the trend for print newspapers is stabilizing and even reversing?
Certainly not reversing.
Yeah.
I think print is just going to play a different role than it has in the past, and I think it's a real mistake to evaluate the Free Press by looking at our print. You know, there's a lot of good stories that appear on our website much sooner than you're going to see them in print. And, you know, sometimes I'm not sure every story that we publish ends up in print even. So the future is definitely digital. You know, there's no way to reverse that. I think the way people, especially, you know, younger generations,
yeah,
than, you know, anyone younger than me. You know, I'm 64, so.
That's young.
You know, my mother, 91-year-old mother, gets her news from her iPad. So, you know, that's definitely the way people are going to consume news going forward. And you know, we have to meet readers where they are.
Yeah, that's telling. Got about 30 seconds left, Aki. But how have the first few months of being in charge been for you?
Interesting. You know, we have some openings that we're trying to fill. We have 3 reporter openings, so if people are interested, they should let us know. We're trying to hire, which is encouraging. Yeah. You know, and then I got to find my replacement. So that's been my focus these first couple of months. But it's also exhilarating. You know, it's a fun job. It's a job that I've thought about for, you know, a few years, and it doesn't disappoint.
Excellent. Aki Soga has been with the Burlington Free Press since 1991, took over as the paper's executive editor earlier this summer. Aki, best of luck. Thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
All right. Good talking to you, Rick.
Good talking to you. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we're going to return to find out how things are at Drop-In Brewing in Middlebury. And tonight, the Sox have the night off, so we've got the full Brady Farkas show, followed by Jazz with George Thomas. That's from 7 to 9. Then Eye on the World with John Batchelor. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. One of the amazing assets we have in this state is the microbreweries that have opened here. It not only means we have easy access to fresh, delicious beer and an amazing variety, but it is also a reason for many visitors to make a trip here in the first place. One such brewery is Middlebury's Drop-In Brewing, and joining me now is the founder and brewmaster, Steve Parks. Steve, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Steve about Drop-In, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Steve, when did you start brewing?
I've only ever been a brewer. I had a degree in brewing from a university in Edinburgh in Scotland, and got a job in a brewery straight out of school, and have been a brewer ever since.
What was the first brewery you worked at?
Yeah, it was right out of university, a brewery in Somerset, England, called Barrow Brewing, and it was tiny, one man operated, brewed, sold, delivered, packaged, did everything myself.
Oh my!
Right in at the deep end, yes.
Wow, and so, but what was it, you know, prior to that, that got you interested in the brewing trade?
Well, I was science classes in high school, physics, chemistry, biology, mm-hmm. math, and I was looking for something to study at university, and it struck me that the brewing combined all of those things. It's a very scientific discipline at its heart, but also had an element of artistry about it. There's some kind of inspiration that goes into putting recipes together to create products that people enjoy as part of their everyday lives. And so there was the combination, I suppose, of the potential for artistry, plus also combining that with the scientific disciplines that I was kind of fond of at the time as well.
Mm. And then when did Drop-In Brewing get started?
Drop-In Brewing began 10 years ago here in Middlebury. I'd spent my career working for others. I must admit I've had a fair amount of responsibility and reasonable autonomy for throughout my career working with other brewers. But for the first time in my life, it was me striking out on my own and realizing that that there was nobody to say, "Steve, that's a stupid idea" anymore. And it was single swim, as it were.
You kept a little notebook of all the stupid ideas you've ever had in your life. You got to drop it and said, "Oh yes, here we go."
Some of them are seared into my memory, I must admit.
What's the stupidest?
Long hours in sales meetings.
Yeah.
You know, also, I mean, that has helped me avoid all of that.
Yeah, well done. What will people find when they drop in at Drop-In?
Yes, we are a small brewery, but we've got big quality. We've got associated with the American Brewers Guild Brewing School, which means we are funded, and we have a laboratory and state of the art processes that that brewers of our similar size don't really have that advantage of. Mm. But you'll see a wide range of traditionally perhaps British and maybe German historical styles being reproduced and recreated. A lot of breweries in Vermont get their start making big, hazy, juicy IPAs. So there's a lot of those around, and so we kind of steer clear of that, letting the others that are more enthusiastic about that style perhaps than I am carry that forward. You'll find Scottish ale, you'll find an English pub beer, you'll find a couple of German lagers. We do try to represent the classics if we can.
Mm. And you mentioned the American Brewers Guild. Are there instructions that people take through the guild there at Drop-In?
Absolutely. I've been running the American Brewers Guild now for over 25 years, and we've been teaching professional brewing during that time. Some years we had as many as 100 students. It's slackened off a little bit as we slowed down. We're probably seeing about 30 students a year now, and they all end up getting jobs as professional brewers at the end of their education. But they do come to us here in Middlebury for a week of hands-on instruction as part of the six-month program. And then they head off to do an apprenticeship at a large brewery, and we've got several breweries around the nation that have participated in that with us.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And are you still offering a beer appreciation course there at Drop-In?
If anyone wants to have one, yes. If you want to come and learn about how to appreciate beer, then yeah, we've done a few of those in the past, and they've always been fun to do.
I think sometimes just sitting at the bar is all you need to be part
you
of a beer
what?
Appreciation
there's
course.
There's somebody to talk to you that knows a lot about beer. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just I've got some really great people working for me as well. So.
All right, you got me very thirsty now. So let's pour me a cold one. I think I'd like to try your favorite first, the Check Your Ego. So tell us about that one.
Check Your Ego. That's a Czech-style Pilsner. Pilsner is a style of beer that developed a couple of hundred years ago in the middle part of Europe. German brewers make a specific type of Pilsner, which tends to be bigger and heavier and more robust, whereas the original Pilsner is a town in the Czech Republic. The original Pilsner tended to be a little bit lighter, pale lager with more expressive sort of hop aroma. So it's a little bit hoppier, but not to the level of an IPA, but
right.
Still crisp and dry and clean, easy to drink, obviously cold and cold drink and hot. A cold beer on a hot day is perfect. They use a variety of hop that's grown specifically in that part of the world called Saaz, S-A-A-Z it's spelled, and any true Czech Bohemian Pilsner has that kind of hop, that hop variety in it, and it's pretty distinctive.
And Steve, when I pick up a Pilsner, you mentioned that one word that I really am looking for, and you nail it there at Drop-In. I don't know how as a brewer you get this, but that crispness. How is that? How does that go from, you know, what you throw in a vat and cook up, and that crispness is still, you know, noticeable in that final product?
Yeah, there are a number of specific brewing techniques. Some crispness is a brewing term that has, you know, come to mean sort of dry in the finish, but I think it also means a balance of the level of bitterness being just right, not too long. It doesn't have to linger for too long on the palate. It falls off the palate reasonably quickly. I like to say it's polite. It does what it needs to do and then gets out of the way.
The most British description of a beer I have ever heard in my life.
Yeah. Crisp is, Budweiser is crisp. So Bud Light is crisp. An English pub beer, an ESB, something like that, may have a caramel malt sweetness at the beginning, but it finishes crisp. And then you brewing techniques over the years, understood by the larger breweries, particularly in making those kind of drinks I just mentioned, but also this idea that you balance everything out so that nothing particularly dominates and takes on the drinking experience. There's no off flavors. It doesn't finish sweet. It finishes dry, and the bitterness is there in balance. And you can choose different hop varieties that provide different characteristics of bitterness, and it's part of the skill of being a brewer is to put these recipes together, knowing what you know about the raw materials, and buying the best raw materials you can afford as well.
Yeah. Now, my favorite of what you do even has a song dedicated to it. So let's hear this from Marillion before we talk about Heart of Lothian.
Oh, perfect.
Every time I have one of your beers, I've got to put that on.
Wow.
I don't know if you're a Marillion fan or not.
Oh, I am. You know, from years and years ago. But you know how sometimes classical music can be so beautiful it brings tears to your eyes?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sorry, but that guitar solo there. That's the thing for me.
No doubt.
Hey. Born with a Heart of Lothian.
Yeah, come isn't on. That beautiful?
Yeah, Edinburgh is in Lothian County, so it's a tribute to the city of Edinburgh, where I did my degree in brewing, and where I had many happy memories of growing up, and so wanted to bring that to the fore.
Oh, there is a football club in Edinburgh called Heart of Midlothian. I actually got to see Fish, the former lead singer of Marillion, perform a few years back in Liverpool, and it was fabulous. So.
Oh, man. I was walking home from the college, my last class of the day, to the railway station. I stopped off for a pint at the Edinburgh Student Union, the Edinburgh University Students Union, and this band were playing, and guy was in a big pointy mask, and the audience was shouting out for Genesis songs. And it was Marillion. I had to get a train so I could spend about 15 minutes with them, and it was great.
Oh, that's fabulous. Well, tell us about that beer, the Heart of Lothian, this beautiful Scottish ale.
Yes. See, a lot of people, I think there's been a fair bit of sort of misrepresentation of what a Scottish ale is over the years, and misunderstandings, I suppose. They tend to be produced by American brewers. They tend to be sweet and very mild and not have a great deal of bitterness. But beers I drank growing up in Scotland weren't necessarily sweet. They may have had an initial kind of blast of caramel sweetness, but they certainly finished dry. And if you're going to be making a beer that you want people to drink many, many pints of, which is obviously a Scottish tradition as well, then you want a dry finish so that you're not drinking that last part of the glass. It's not cloyingly sweet. It's back to that word crisp again, and a nice dry finish, and so you're still thirsty effectively.
Right.
So you want another beer, and that's kind of how you build on drinkability, which is the other phrase it's worth introducing. But the Scottish beer, Scots have a very sweet tooth by tradition, by historically. Most candy consumed in Europe is consumed in Scotland, and per capita, and so they like sweet things, and caramel or crystal malt is an appropriate an addition to this beer. It gives it that caramel sweetness initially as a first flavor that you get, but also you've got to balance that out somehow. The historical perception of Scottish beers is because hops were all grown. There are no hops grown in Scotland. They're grown in England and Germany, and the Scots don't necessarily want to buy ingredients from those countries. So the low level of fairly low level of bitterness. So again, it makes it for a delicious, full bodied, well rounded group of flavors that people just can't get enough of.
Oh,
and to be honest, when there's a lot of hoppy IPAs around, offering a restaurant or bar something that is so easy to and approachable, but also different, I think is what served us pretty well.
Yeah, well done. Steve, I feel like I'm sitting right there at Drop-In, right across the bar from you. Now, surprise me with something you think I'll enjoy.
Ah, well, we've got a really interesting couple of beers on tap at the moment. We are working with a new company, New Ireland Brewing Company, and we've been developed a couple of recipes for them, and they are interested in creating a new Irish stout to be served using nitrogen gas to push it, and similar to Guinness, but hopefully fresher, better, and made in Vermont. And we've also got a beer they call New Ireland Bright, which is a lager-style beer served using the nitrogen to push it as well. So nitrogen is an interesting gas in beer. It doesn't dissolve very well, but when it does, it creates a really smooth, creamy texture and very small bubbles for a very long-lasting head on top. So it looks wonderful when you pour it. And again, it's super easy to drink and very enjoyable. So that one I think might surprise you. It's a unique thing, and we've got it on tap at the moment.
I've got to head south and get there pretty soon. I get the feeling that you and the crew at Drop-In take real pride in your knowledge of beers. How important is it for you and your staff to have that deep beer education?
It's really important. The main thing about any brewery tasting room, over the last few years, certainly post-COVID, it seems to have the business model for breweries is to have tasting rooms where people visit and try the beer at the source. And that has really exploded in the recent past. But one of the things that has been lost in that is that now there's a little bit of a tendency to compete as a bar or a restaurant. Well, I need bars and restaurants to serve drop-in brewing beer and spread the word and get the beer out there into the trade. So I'm not going to go toe-to-toe as competition with them. So what we've stuck to the very, the original idea of what a brewery tasting room should be, and that's to sample and to enjoy beers at the source, but at the same time learn about the process, the products, and beer in general. And as a result, we've trained our staff to talk knowledgeably about beer styles and about how beer is brewed and the brewing process. My brewer, who's Seth Howard, who's here every day as well, is also spent time out in the front there, answering questions, talking with customers about beer styles. Gina Sherwood, who works with us behind the scenes, is also educated and trained. She did an internship at a famous brewery in Scotland when she was younger, and has traveled and is educated about beer. And myself, obviously, we're here to help people learn. You mentioned the beer education, beer education classes. That's what we do. We're educators as well. So while it's fun to brew different styles, it's also, I think, important to spread the gospel that there's more to beer than the fizzy yellow stuff you drink with pizza. Or at a summer barbecue. There's styles of world traditional styles that are appropriate for those, but also other different ways that beer can be beer that can be brewed and flavors that can be expressed. There's all kinds of things happening at the moment, and we want to be there to help explain it.
When is your tap room open, Steve?
It opens at 12 o'clock every day, except for Sundays, and It's only open until about 5. We don't want to get into competing with the restaurant crowd for dinners and services and things. There's a sandwich shop next door that you can eat something while you're here. But we're here to offer an experience during the day, which is unusual for around here. Not many places actually are even open during the afternoon. So something for people to do.
And you know, you've kind of poo-pooed it, but you really are a big deal in the brewing industry. I think you've received an honor that's like being inducted into the Brewing Industry's Hall of Fame. You've also been a judge for the World Beer Cup, and we always hear about the brewing awards that beers win, but what is it like? First of all, how do you get chosen for that, and what's it like to judge something at that level?
Oh, it's an incredible experience. Being invited, Bill, you know, you mentioned industry figure, Hall of Fame stuff, and that's really, you know, I've been noticed. I've written some parts of some brewing textbooks over my career and been technical editor of a couple of magazines and stuff. So it's just being part of the industry and being recognized as one of the people that have been around since the beginning. I mean, I arrived in America in 1988 and started the first brewery in Maryland since a major brewery was built there three or four decades earlier. I went to the state to open the brewery and they didn't have any forms. So we don't know what to do. But the World Beer Cup is incredible. Some of the best beer judges in the world. The last one I did back in April of this year, only 25% of the judges were from America. So I was judging with judges from Belgium, from Germany, from South America, from the UK, from Japan, from South Korea. I judged with a judge from South Korea, and Africa as well, different countries in Africa. So it truly is a world event, and some of the best judges in the world are invited to participate. So it's a truly tremendous, absolutely tremendous honor. And sitting at the table with some of the best beers you've ever had, not knowing who brewed them, not knowing what they are. You know what style they're supposed to be, and you judge them based on the rules regarding that style, and then you discuss it with like I said, some of the best beer judges you'll ever meet. It's tremendous. It's an amazing honor. Heading out to do the Great American Beer Festival, which will be my 20th time doing that, or 23rd time doing that. So,
congratulations!
Pretty excited about that. Yeah.
Steve Parks is the founder and brewmaster at Drop-In Brewing. And to learn more, you can visit dropinbrewing.com. Steve, absolutely great having you on the show this morning, having another Marillion fan with me. Thank you very much.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, Rick. I really appreciate the chance to talk.
Sure,
thank you.
Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll return to speak with Kevin O'Connor of VT Digger about a couple of the state's political icons. And coming up this morning at 11, it's Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. As we race towards the next historic general election in Vermont, let's take a breath and look back to the 70s when the demographics in the state were changing drastically, and so too the political leaning of Vermont. We're going to spend some time looking back at the careers of two Vermonters who won statewide races for the first time in that decade. We'll be learning about Governor Tom Salmon and Senator Patrick Leahy, whose autobiography, The Road Traveled, was just published. Joining me now to take us on that journey is someone who has written about them recently for VTDigger.org, Kevin O'Connor. Kevin, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Kevin a question about Governor Salmon or Senator Leahy, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kevin, paint the picture of where Vermont was politically in 1972.
Well, Rick, what's interesting is I am old enough to be able to tell people that I was born on the day that Phil Hoff was elected the first Democratic governor in the state of Vermont, and that was in November of 1962. But a lot of Vermonters, especially younger ones, don't realize that back in the 60s and 70s, while we think of Vermont today in terms of Ben and Jerry's and Bernie Sanders, it was a real Republican stronghold. In fact, it had voted Republican in terms of both the presidential race and also the governor's race up until 1962 for Republicans, never electing a Democrat. So when Phil Hoff was elected a Democrat in 1962, this was a new thing for Vermont. So 50 years ago in 1972, other than Phil Hoff, Vermont was a real Republican stronghold.
Now, when we say, you know, how red this state was, you know, up until that time that Hoff was elected or even Salmon in 72, that Republican Party, though, was a bit different politically than, say, you know, some of the far right wing of the party today.
Very much so. In fact, I would simply say that Phil Scott would have been very, very comfortable as a Republican in 1962 and 1972 in Vermont, and likewise a Vermont Republican would recognize Phil Scott as sort of who they knew Republicans to be in the state.
Good point. That's a great way to describe the philosophy then. Apart from the gubernatorial results in 1972, how did the state go when it came to the other statewide elections?
It was interesting. In November of 1972, Vermont elected all Republicans. They went for President Richard Nixon, who was going for a reelection, by a nearly 2-to-1 margin, and every state office except for one went Republican. The one that didn't go Republican, which was the governor's race, is probably the race that had the most interesting story behind it.
Yeah, and that's where we're going. Now, let's look at this guy, Tom Salmon. Where was he from? And prior to running for governor, what was his background?
Tom Salmon was born in the Midwest, grew up in Massachusetts, and in 1958 decided to move to Vermont. He had gone to law school and wanted to practice as an attorney, so he moved to Rockingham, and specifically its village of Bellows Falls, and started working as an attorney. He soon found himself running for state representative and was in the state house, the House of Representatives, representing Rockingham in the 1960s. But at that point, you know, it was more, you know, he was starting to raise a family and deciding to sort of get into a little bit of politics, but he didn't have real big aspirations at that time.
Had he developed a strong campaign organization leading up to that 72 gubernatorial election?
No. What's really we'll just cut to the chase.
Yeah.
No. What's really interesting about this story is when 1972 dawned, the Democrats were really in disarray, and the Republicans were really coming from a position of strength. One of the challenges the Democrats had in 1972 is the more centrist Democrats were supporting presidential candidates in the primary, such as Ed Muskie, who was a senator from Maine, or the former Vice President Hubert Humphrey. There was another group that was looking for more of a liberal position and specifically found that in George McGovern, who was campaigning on the idea that if I win, I will immediately end the Vietnam War. So that national division was also found in Vermont. And as a result of that, Vermont Democrats really couldn't come up with a slate of candidates to put in for 1972. Tom Salmon went to Miami in the Democratic National Convention that year as a McGovern delegate. and listened to all of the speeches and recognized, while it seemed to be crazy that they thought their candidate could beat, at that time, a very popular President Nixon, something in him said, we have to try, we have to go forward. And so literally hours before the deadline to put his name on the ballot in August of 1972, he decides, I will run as a gubernatorial candidate for the Democrats.
Wow. I do remember that 72 presidential election. Hubert Humphrey went by HHH. Do you remember what the middle H stood for?
Unfortunately, I do not.
It was Hubert Horatio Humphrey. There's a trivia question for the next time you're sitting around with friends and you want to win, you know, a quarter. All right. Now, what can you tell us about the Republican candidate for governor in 72?
Well, it's interesting. There was a primary for the Republican nomination for governor in 1972. The gentleman who won was by the name of Luther Hackett. He was a businessman from up in Chittenden County, and he was supported by the then governor at the time, who was Dean Davis, who a lot of people know in the insurance or knew from the insurance industry. There was another candidate, though, in that GOP gubernatorial primary, and he was the attorney general at the time, and his name was James Jeffords. Now, we all know what happened to James Jeffords after 1972. He went to the House and then to the U.S. Senate and became a maverick Republican until he didn't become a Republican or chose not to be a Republican and went independent. At the time in 1972, though, Jim Jeffords was sort of this Republican candidate who the establishment really didn't quite understand and decided, no, they were going to get behind Luther Hackett. So Luther Hackett was the Republican candidate at the time. Obviously, other than people who might be in business, that's not a name that a lot of Vermonters remember. But one of the reasons why this is interesting is Republicans thought they were coming from a position of strength, but back in 1972, that primary between Luther Hackett and Jim Jeffords started to put a crack in that Republican Party, specifically those who were more establishment-focused and then those who sort of liked the more maverick position that Jim Jeffords took. And that was something that Tom Salmon was able to sort of use to his advantage.
And I think that happened in 62 as well when Phil Hoff won. So, you know, there were wings of the Republican Party at that time, and sometimes they just couldn't come together. And that gave the Democrats a little bit of oxygen. But wait, Kevin, there was another guy in that race from the Liberty Union Party.
There was another guy in the race. And what's interesting is everybody thought that Tom Salmon had no chance in the world. How could anyone who announces in August for a November election and was Democratic win? The only person that everybody in Vermont thought had absolutely even longer odds would absolutely never win election in the state was the Liberty Union candidate. That was a third party. And his name was Bernie Sanders. And this gentleman was running his first race in the state of Vermont, came out of that race with about 1% of the vote. But again, you may have heard of Bernie Sanders, who also defied the odds in the future, just like Tom Salmon.
Congratulations to any believers back then who voted for Bernie Sanders in 1972. You had great vision is all we can say. Okay, let's talk about the results. What happened? How shocking was this?
I think what was surprising about this, I have to remind people, especially my younger colleagues, this was before the personal computer. This was before the cell phone.
Right,
this
right.
was before social media. There weren't a lot of, there wasn't a lot of polling. There wasn't a lot of ways that you could sort of determine who might be gaining ground. So there really was this feeling going into the November election that the Republicans always won. Of course, the Republicans are going to win. I think where things got a little surprising, though, was when Montpelier came in. That was Governor Davis's hometown. They gave Salmon won that by 600 votes. Plymouth, which is the birthplace of the late Republican President Calvin Coolidge, they voted for Salmon. So town after town started coming in, and Salmon was winning them. So by about 10:20 that election night, Walter Cronkite went on CBS and announced, and this, in fact, this is his quote, "It looks like there's an upset in the making in Vermont." And in 25 words or less, I think what happened was the Republicans sort of took it for granted that they were going to win it. A lot of Republicans who were for Jeffords sort of figured like, maybe we'll try this guy, Tom Salmon. And Tom Salmon really sort of painted himself as an underdog who wasn't part of a machine, but was just an average man who cared about things like property taxes and development, and people took a chance on him.
What happened after his 2 years as governor? How's he doing today?
Tom Salmon celebrated his 90th birthday on Friday. So what's interesting, and I should actually plug this, I wrote a story which is now on Vermont Digger's website about Tom Salmon and about the fact, in fact, the title is 50 Years Later, Tom Salmon Revisits the Biggest Political Upset in Vermont History. By the way, the words biggest political upset in Vermont history was what the Burlington Free Press put on its front page that day. They were so shocked. Tom is now 90, so in addition to this being the 50th year of his win, it's also his 90th year on the planet. He's now here in Brattleboro, where I'm based out of. Tom is not as talkative, and yet when I was showing him some old photographs from 50 years ago, he was definitely able to name names, and you could see the spirit in his eyes that he definitely remembers this upset of 50 years ago.
Ah, beautiful. Let's go to Newbury. We've got Fred on the line. Hi, Fred.
Morning.
Morning.
Hey, you know this is very interesting. We were talking about Leahy and Feinstein and who else? They're all oligarchs. Anyways, if you take organizations like the Senate, the House, the bureaucracy of the United States, you can go into any large company. They're all run it's a geriatric oligarchy. So our country basically is a geriatric oligarchy. Now, if you look at the Constitution, this is very interesting. The Constitution was signed by people that were actually old-timers. They were in their 40s. They said the the average age of the constitutional signers was 44 years old. And there are also some 30 or 35-year-olds that are a part of the deal. But if you look at the life expectancy back then,
right,
they basically were old men.
Yeah. Good point, Fred. Thanks for that. A good way to get us into the next topic. First of all, Kevin, 2 years after Tom Salmon was elected governor, Bernie Sanders ran again, this time for the U.S. Senate. Who are the Republican and Democratic candidates in that race?
Well, unfortunately for Bernie, he had yet another try as Liberty Union candidate, but there was yet another Democrat that ran in that race and won in that race. For people who don't remember, the seat had been held for decades by George Aiken.
Right.
From my neck of the woods in Putney, and there was George Aiken decided to retire at age 82, and three men decided to run for it. One was Bernie Sanders' Liberty Union. Another was the current U.S. representative at the time, a Republican by the name of Richard Mallory, and the third was the Chittenden County State's Attorney, and he was Patrick Leahy.
And I think Bernie this time got a little bit closer to 3 or 4%. So he was gaining massive momentum there in the early 70s. But it took until he became the mayor of Burlington to really chart a victory. So here's Patrick Leahy. He's about, I think, 34 years old. What was his background before running for the U.S. Senate?
Patrick had grown up, the senator had grown up in Montpelier. Was actually his family ran the Leahy Press, but he decided to go to law school down at Georgetown and saw the U.S. Capitol, and something in him said, this is the place for me. Hmm. So he came back to Vermont, worked for the Chittenden County. He was the Chittenden County State's Attorney. And then when Aiken decided to retire, he decided this is my chance to get back to Washington, and he ran for U.S. Senate and became the first Democrat to win a Senate seat in Vermont, and actually the only Democrat so far. Bernie has been running as an independent.
And there had been talk of Leahy possibly having his sights set on governor, didn't run in 72, waited till 74, ran for Senate. Wasn't a massive margin, though, was it? And how surprising was it that Leahy won the race, even though at the time Vermont did have a Democratic governor?
I think it was surprising. I think the fact that Richard Mallory, the Republican, had been a congressman already. But I think this, the 1972 and the 1974 races with Salmon and Leahy, were sort of where Vermont started to shift. And there were a lot of people coming from out of state who had more liberal views. There were less people who were voting Republican simply because that's what Vermont did. So I think this period of time is when the shift that the Vermont that people know politically now is when it started to really start to evolve.
And, Kevin, we should mention that Richard Nixon reelected, but between 72 and the election of 74, Watergate broke.
Correct.
Yeah, so that did have quite a effect on who was sent to Washington in that 74 election. And you hear sometimes Patrick Leahy being referred to as a Watergate baby. it's hard to say that now at his age. Philip Baruth wrote a biography of Senator Leahy a few years ago. But to your knowledge, is this the first, other than that, biography or autobiography about Senator Leahy? This one is called The Road Taken.
This is called The Road Taken. It is. Philip Baruth did write a book called Senator Leahy a couple of years ago. But this is the first time that the senator himself has written his own story. It's actually coming out tomorrow, Tuesday, although I have a story going on Vermont Digger this afternoon, letting people know what to expect in the book. So you guys are getting the preview before the preview.
Yes.
It's 480 pages. I, in the summary, sort of call it more of a labor of love versus a hard look at history. It's the senator sort of offering stories from his first election in 1974 to him presiding over Donald Trump's second impeachment trial in last year. So he really sort of spans the decades and tells stories of what he remembers.
Any idea why? I mean, he's now going to retire. Why he didn't wait until he was retired back on the farm in Vermont to write this one, or while he wrote it while he was still serving?
I don't. I mean, I think the only thing, and this is total speculation, but when you read the acknowledgments, a lot of the book in terms of the help writing it, he credits his staff as well as some support from some editors and some organizers. So I feel in a way that he probably figured while he was still in the Senate, while he still had access to all of these people with the memories who could support him, it would make more sense for him to try to tackle this now than to wait until he got back home.
Yeah, plus he wouldn't have to shuffle off some classified documents back to the farm in Vermont to refer to. So you don't want to be doing that right now. The title is a nod to Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken. Is he a Frost fan?
He is, and he actually recalls one of his inspirations for deciding to run was John F. Kennedy. And Robert Frost read a poem at John F. Kennedy's inauguration. And so I feel between the Frost being from Vermont, but also Frost reading at John F. Kennedy's inauguration, those sort of two inspirations sort of kept Leahy or inspired Leahy to sort of like Frost.
Yeah, I like that. What are some of his hobbies, outside interests?
You know, I have to say the book itself is very much based on the Senate. He doesn't really talk a lot about there's a reference or two to liking Batman and being in a Batman movie,
right,
which people have heard about. But I think the thing that's interesting about the book is it's 480 pages of his work in the U.S. Senate. The other place I will say that gets mentioned a lot is the Congressional Gym, where he seems to be bumping into everybody. That's where he met Barack Obama when Obama was a new U.S. senator from Illinois. And Obama supposedly, according to Leahy, looked down at Patrick Leahy's sneakers and said, the 80s are calling and they want the shoes back. So,
burn. How about that, Barack? And, I mean, knowing Senator Leahy, I can't imagine this is going to be the case. But will we find even an ounce of scandalous or tell-all material in this book?
Well, there isn't in the book. I think Vermonters might have some questions. If you live in Burlington and you don't like the F-35s, for example, you might question why the senator didn't mention the fact that he was a supporter of that. People who have been following the EB-5 case in the Northeast Kingdom might question why the senator was an early supporter of the EB-5 before we found out the problems with the Ponzi scheme there. So there are a couple of, you know, things in the senator's past that people who might have some knowledge of, you know, might question why isn't that in the book. I think that's why I call it more of a labor of love versus a hard look at history. Then again, when you're trying to sum up 82 years in 480 pages, you can't put everything in.
Yeah, and anything that might cause blushes, it's a good time to leave. Good thing to leave out of your autobiography. Kevin O'Connor writes for vtdigger.org, based out of Brattleboro. Kevin, always informative having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break. CBS News Update is next, and then we'll be back to open those phones wide. And coming up today at 1, we present 3 incredible hours of music on The Getaway, brought to you by the refreshed and ready Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. All right, we've got open phones. What is there to gab about this morning? The phones are, wait, let's make sure. Danny, are they? Yes, he gave me the high sign from director extraordinaire Danny McGivergan that the phones have been placed in the open position for you. Yeah. 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. We've got Bill LaBeouf and the Bold Vikings, our new house band, covering Steely Dan's Ricky Don't Lose That Number for the open phones. I'm not sure if the band knows this, but this album, Pretzel Logic, was the very first album I ever bought. That's out of thousands of pieces of vinyl, CDs that I own. So this was first, and then number two was Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. It was my second album. First CD was a band called Animal Logic. That band had Stuart Copeland, the drummer from The Police, after The Police broke up. Great jazz bass player named Stanley Clark. And then they did a nationwide search to find a voice. And they were listening to cassettes, and they heard this woman named Deborah Holland. And maybe we'll get to play a little bit of that for you at some point, but that Animal Logic was my first CD. So let's go there. What was your first 45? What was your first LP or CD that you owned? And if possible, we'll see, maybe lightning fast Danny, will be able to get a song on for you. I've got Roger Hill band names I can go over. I've got the best, cheap album I ever bought. Remember those cutout bins we used to peruse? I think it was 99 cents. All right. And then, of course, you can go the Duke of Newbury route and chat about whatever else you'd like. Our number is 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You could talk about great concerts you've been to. I know we like to talk about that, don't we? All right. Let's where are we going to start here? You all ready for me? Go to the Duke of Newbury. The Duke without portfolio, Your Grace.
Hey, you know, I was searching through YouTube, mm-hmm. and I stumbled upon a song. It's a symphonic song for symphony and soprano voice.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to listen to this. It's unbelievable. The best woman that sings it is a woman by the name of Suzanne Ahrens does an unbelievable job of it.
And what is it we're going to?
Go ahead.
What's the song? What's the piece that we're looking for?
The piece is "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina."
Oh, okay. All right. We'll put Danny on that.
It's really good. You gotta listen to it. It's such a catchy song. I can't get over it.
All right, we know that tune, but we'll try to find Suzanne Ahrens version of that and get that on. Thanks for that, Fred. All right, let's move on to Eden and speak with Brian. Good morning, Brian. What's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I'm always following Fred on his coattails here.
He's always the leadoff hitter in these open phones, so you got to have fast fingers to beat Fred.
I have two things. One is kind of fun. I don't know if the other one is. But anyway, and also I have a reference to one time George Bush out of nowhere said, "Don't cry for me, Argentina." And no one knew what he was talking about.
Oh, no kidding.
George Bush Sr. Oh. He used to say weird non sequiturs all the time. But my first concerts, just to give you an idea, this is such a weird – this would have been around 78, 79. I saw the Charlie Daniels Band.
Ah.
And then I saw the Charlie Daniels Band again. And then I went to Alice Cooper. Right?
Yeah.
How's that for a dichotomy?
Yeah.
And then Marshall Tucker Band. And then I saw the Jim Carroll Band, which was another kind of.
Oh, yeah. These are the people who died. Jim Carroll
Band. Yeah, exactly. It was that tour. And so it was a very eclectic beginning to my concert.
Wow.
Yeah.
Charlie Daniels twice. You got Alice Cooper, Marshall Tucker, and Jim Carroll. Jim Carroll, band for people who don't know, were probably more on the kind of new wavy sound, that time. That's an interesting lineup. And Brian, so that's your formative years. So where do your musical tastes lie today?
Local. Always local.
Nicely
always
done.
The local.
Yeah. Any band that you want to give a nod to?
Oh, goodness gracious. Steal or Borrow, I have a soft spot for them always because I've known those guys forever. I used to go to Dead shows with the guys from Fish before they were famous. And I remember just hanging out with them, and they'd look around, they'd check out the light system, and they go, you know, someday this will be us. And it was like, cool, hope so.
Wow.
And that seemed to have worked out for them.
Yeah.
No, big concerts, I try not to see anything that's outside of Vermont if I can avoid it.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, I like outdoor. It's always fun to dance.
Cool.
The other thing is a little more serious, and it's just not to put a cloud on things, but I'm really concerned about the Ukrainians shelling that nuclear plant.
Well, so do you know that the thing.
The Russians are there.
Yeah.
And the Russians are using it as a shield.
Right.
So somebody's shelling it, and I doubt they would shell themselves.
Well, true, but how disgusting. Nobody's wearing white at this, right? But how disgusting to launch missiles from that area, right? To begin, war is dirty. It's just dirty.
They just need a truce in that area.
Yeah, please. I'm with you, Brian. There's no right way. Ugh.
But other local bands, I talked to Greg about this probably because it's what he plays a lot of times, but Abby Sherman is really good. She's a local memorial. Anything by Abby Sherman, I like Adonis Mitchell. I like anybody from Lamar, really. I'm kind of a snob that way.
I will tell you, Brian, that, you know, I've gone to, you know, numerous live shows through the years, and I have never seen anyone more often than Anais Mitchell in a lot of different ways. I mean, from the very early or first Hadestown done at the Barry Opera House to her solo stuff to a group of wonderful local female artists doing a Bob Dylan night down at Langdon Street Cafe, seeing her solo a number of times, seeing her with Bonnie Light Horseman. So, a great person to bring up. Maybe we can get an Anais tune in there from her.
Cat Wright is good too.
Oh, Cat Wright. There's another one. Yeah. All right. Thanks so much, Brian. I love his his direction right now. You know, there are so many great Vermont artists that you can get out and support. And earlier this year, I did that. Zoe Keating, who we've had on here, got to see her. She's a fabulous cellist who has moved to Burlington. And so there was this great run of Cat Wright and Anais and Zoe and other local artists. Who did I see? What was the name of the band that came back? They have a new name. But anyway, it was really pretty sweet at the beginning of the year as bands start to play again. All right, we're going to keep these phones open, and we'll get more of your calls on 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. We'll talk music this morning. If you don't call, you know I'll just, you know, natter on. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We're talking about your first or favorite albums that you owned, or 45, or CDs, or those ever-lovable downloads, or a great concert. Yeah, there's no warmth with a download, is there? My sibs and I were into 45s growing up, but I do remember when our cool Aunt Susan gave my brother a Meet the Beatles album back in the 60s. I think we beat the heck out of that thing. But how great was that? Aunt Susie was also crazy about Ricky Nelson. And the story has it with my family that she begged my mother, which was her older sister, to name me after Ricky Nelson. So that's the family lore, at least. I am named after Ricky Nelson. So, okay, let's go. Give us some of your faves, or maybe someone famous you're named after, or named one of your children after. Phones are open at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. We were just talking to Brian from Eden about Anais Mitchell. Let's play a little bit from her latest album is self-titled, and this is Bright Star from Anais Mitchell.
Bright star, when I first laid eyes upon you, I was filled with such a longing to be with you in the dark. Bright star, since I could not fly beside you, I would chart my own course by you, and I'd sail it by your light. Bright star.
And this new album, Anais Mitchell, self-titled, kind of goes back to her early days. She has moved back to Addison County. I think she's moved into the home of her grandmother. And so she's connecting with the places and the people and the ephemera of her youth, of her early days. And it really comes through in the music. On this latest album, I got a quick little Anais story. The first time I went to see her, and like I said, I think I've seen her about 14 times. She was playing at Higher Ground that night. It was when The Brightness came out, that album. And I was at the Montpelier post office, and I'm behind this bouncy, bubbly young woman, and she's got mailers, and I'm assuming now that they were CDs she was sending out. And I thought, I wonder, is that? Nah, I'm not going to ask her. And I thought, maybe that's Anais Mitchell. Well, later that night, I see her on stage, and I'm thinking, you jerk. She was right in front of you at the post office in Montpelier, and you didn't say, hey. All right, let's head to Corinth. Talk to Wade. How's it going, Wade?
Good morning, Rick. Good morning. And this is a follow-up.
Yes, please.
From several times I've mentioned, and I began to wonder if it was even fictitious, if it ever happened or not. But when I was in high school, dating my now wife in 1978, dates us a little bit, that the band Boston played in the Dartmouth College hockey rink in Hanover. And I began to wonder if it even happened because I couldn't find any information on it. I finally found it. It was November 3rd or 4th, 1978. They blew up here, played a 15-song set without encore, and then got on their bus and headed straight to Detroit.
How about that? Oh, that's so cool.
My mother, neither one of us had a driver's license. My mother gave us a date night in the back of her 66 T-Bird down to Hanover and picked us up and out back. And, you know, they probably only sat, you know, I don't know, 3,500 people or something, which would have been minuscule for where Boston was at in 1978.
Yeah, so they had the album out already, and they were – so that would have been probably even their second album, would they have been on?
Maybe, probably Don't Look Back.
Don't Look Back, yeah.
Yeah, and another Brad Delp, is it Don or John Schultz?
Yep.
Put that all together. Yep. Boston did not exist as a band, as a touring band. They had never played together until they finally out of popular demand, went on tour.
Yeah.
Everything was dubbed in tracks.
Yeah.
And they were put together as single musicians from different locations.
Oh, wow.
And Schultz was putting that together. And finally, it was so popular, they had to go on tour. They had to put the band together, which didn't exist.
Well, and if you remember, you know, 1978 – colleges could attract bands like that, right? They could pull them in when they were on their way, you know, to Detroit, and they had a night, and they would stop in and play. And let's go right across the lake from, you know, Burlington in Plattsburgh. So they used to pull in bands. Bands would camp there, Wade, and practice for a week before they'd head out on tour, like Talking Heads did that. But
I always figured it was some well-to-do alumni pulled it in for their kids' frat house.
No, not back then. you had like a little bit of money, you know, from the college, and you could attract bands to stop. And so Frampton, Peter Frampton, who wasn't really known that well at the time, he was going to have a live album, and he comes back with, you know, one album's worth of material, and the record label said, we want a second. We want to make it a double. And they sent him up to Plattsburgh, and he played there in the basketball gymnasium, and about four songs on that whatever it was, platinum album, that thing went crazy in 76. Four of the songs came from him playing in that basketball gymnasium over in Plattsburgh. And so the kid who booked it, you know, he was a student at the time at Plattsburgh State, winds up going and working for a promoter in Boston, and then eventually he's working for Live Nation now. He's one of their executive vice presidents. So back then, Wade, you weren't dreaming. Those things would happen. They could happen on a college campus very easily. Hey, speaking of music, tell us how things went at Northeast Slopes with that big day of music you had.
Well, it was great, great. You know, there was a lot of competition out there, you know, as there is every weekend in Vermont. So the crowd certainly could have been better, but it was a very good, you know, event. We had a couple hundred people come through the gates, probably 40-plus musicians, made up to 18 different acts that did their 20-minute shows. And Highway 5 closed out the show with the Rope Toe Boogie.
Oh, excellent. And
yeah, it was a great day, and it was one of those days that was not sweltering hot,
a little sunny.
We had some raffles. We had a lot of fun with it. Saw some music we'd never, you know, seen or heard acts before, and I think it's going to be a segue to follow up with another one next year, if not, maybe even this fall. That's a, you know, people say, when are you going to do the next one? Let's do it when it's a little cooler and when you get a little more availability. And
maybe.
It went off without a hitch, so it went well, and we'll keep it simple and maybe do another one here.
And, Wade, tell people what the money raised for that day is going to. I love this.
Yeah, we ended up pulling in a little under $2,000 clear for our Waits River Valley School Middle School Youth Ski Program.
Yeah.
Where we supply equipment and instruction and a hill to ski on, and it all went well, and Boo is the new maestro, not only a ski instructor, but music event organizer as well. All went well, and now we got one under our belt of this type. I think it'd be pretty easy to pull off, several a year maybe.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Wade.
Take care. Great, thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Wow, Boston back at Dartmouth back in 78. All right. I think we have music from the very first CD I purchased, which was Animal Logic. That was Stuart Copeland of the Police, Stanley Clark, and Deborah Holland. Do we have that, Danny, ready to go? Danny's on it. He's so on it. All right, let's hear some music from Animal Logic. That is Firing Up the Sunset Gun and Animal Logic. You could probably play that under me and all the way out, Danny. That was my first CD, and so when the Police broke up, Stuart Copeland formed that band, he and Stanley Clark, and then they listened to voices trying to find the right. I just love her voice, so clear and crisp and beautiful. Deborah Holland is her name. Yeah, that still does it for me. All right, Danny, sterling job on this morning's open phones. Now place the padlock back on the phones. We are shutting it down. He does that. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan. And feel free to suggest guests, topics, email me, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we discuss laughing babies. That's right, laughing babies and Hooska. And we'll meet someone who can help you if you're interested in acquiring a franchise.